Okay, the recorder is on. It's August 12th, 2010, and this is the interview of John McMurray. On the call is Clara Moraine, Mina Simhai, Dixie Noonan, and Carl McCartan of the SCIC. And we have John McMurray and Sean Knowles from Perkins Coie. And we are recording the interview. So, Mr. McMurray, as your attorney may have told you, were from the FCIC, which was created by statute in the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009, and were charged with studying the causes of the financial crisis. And part of our mandate is to study the role of subprime lending in this financial crisis and the causes of the financial problems that firms that failed or would have failed, but for government assistance. And so as part of that, we are looking into Countrywide, and Tom Stanton of the FCIC just joined the call. That's S-T-A-N-T-O-N. And so we'll probably ask you, we'll get into more details about Countrywide in a moment, but it would be helpful if you could go into your educational and work background quickly.
Sure. I have an undergraduate degree from Trinity University, an MBA from the University of Texas, San Antonio, a second master's degree from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I'm a CFA, a CPA, so that's a quick flyby on my educational background and certifications. I've worked virtually all of my career for one type of financial institution or another, either a thrift or a commercial bank. And I'll go through this rapidly. I joined Countrywide from Freddie Mac. I'd been at Freddie Mac a number of years in the early 2000s, and then joined Countrywide maybe from like either late 90s, early 2000 into late 2003 at Freddie, and then joined Countrywide. First as their chief credit officer, their enterprise chief credit officer, and then later on moved into the chief risk officer position, and then ultimately left. I resigned from Countrywide in late 2007, September 07, and had been recruited for the prior year before that by Washington Mutual. And so I joined Washington Mutual in September of 2007 upon leaving Countrywide. Stayed there while that whole situation unfolded. Became a J.P. Morgan Chase employee. They wanted me to move to Columbus, which I didn't want to do. So parted ways with J.P. Morgan in November of 2008. Became immediately thereafter a consultant to the Federal Home Loan Bank of Seattle to help them with their first assignment was to help them with their mortgage securities portfolio, which was in full meltdown at that time, and then became the chief risk officer for the Home Loan Bank in early 2009, and that kind of brings us up to the present.
Okay, and just to make sure I have the dates correct, you left Countrywide in the fall of 07, and then you went to WaMu, and then...
With nothing in between, just went immediately from one to the other.
Okay. What was your role at WaMu?
I joined as chief credit officer, and then a few months in, they... terminated the chief risk officer that was in place and then put me in as chief risk officer.
Okay.
So you were the CRO at WaMu when they were acquired by J.P. Morgan?
I was.
So we can kill two birds with one stone with this interview then. That's great.
you could, and I would encourage you guys to look beyond subprime. You started the interview out that way. But I think that, in my opinion, is only a small piece of the puzzle.
Thank you for that clarification. I think that that's certainly our mandate is broader than just looking at subprime. It's all categories of the risky instruments, mortgages that were.
Do you mean Alt A and private label securities, or more than that as well?
I mean more than that as well. If you look at where Fannie and Freddie evolved to, there were a lot of loans being done with high risk characteristics, and in my opinion, I certainly said that at the time, and presented research at the time showing that.
When you say at the time, you're talking about during your time at Countrywide?
Yes.
And is this research that you produced to the board, or are you made publicly available when you say, if you could just explain?
As an example, I presented at the Federal Reserve Bank the one that Chicago Fed does every year. So I presented it there as an example. I presented it at ASF, the American Securitization Forum. So it was shared, investor presentations. It was shared internally and externally.
Chicago was 2008?
No, 2006 is when I presented the risk characteristics or the quantification of the risk characteristics for various loan types.
So your concern is high-risk loans that were called prime as well. Yeah, I'm just trying.
Yeah, in fact, I mean exactly the distinction between prime, Alt A. They're mostly meaningless. It's really the attributes of the loans themselves. In terms of there is an important distinction from a securitization perspective. But a lot of the stuff that people call prime still had high risk characteristics.
Alternative mortgage products.
No.
I wouldn't categorize it that way. I mean, I could go through the series of things.
Maybe you should give us some examples. That would be helpful.
Sure. So here's an example: home equity loans. Most of those are done on a low doc basis. They're considered prime at most institutions, and I think even today you might see some of them done with low doc features, but they're not going to be called low doc. So that's an example. Property inspection waivers that both Fannie and Freddie did. And it would have been done on prime. That was copied into the private label market. Again, loans that weren't put into Alt-A securitization certainly weren't part of the subprime market at all. That would be an example of a risk characteristic.
And you did research quantifying all of these?
We did.
And this was research you did on Countrywide loans or in the broader market?
At Countrywide, we had access to the loan performance database, which is probably the broadest database available. But the best thing that Countrywide had been around for a long time. In fact, one of the reasons I joined them in the beginning from Freddie is I had a chance to look at all of the big institutions that operated in the mortgage market. I mean, if you fill in the large institutions name, and we would have dealt with them. And the infrastructure that Countrywide had for mortgages was far and away better than anyone else had. And so the database that they have and that B of A now has, it is the best data out there, in my opinion. I've got lots of other colleagues that have been other places and that spent some time at Countrywide that would agree with that. And so the best research we did was on the Countrywide data. It was entirely unpolluted by any acquisition or merger. It covered a long period of time. It covered lots of details on each loan. Countrywide's corporate strategy was to have the broadest product menu in the business, so it covered virtually every loan type imaginable. So we could do quantitative studies looking at millions of loans at a time, to see how they were behaving.
So, specific to the research that you did and that you presented at the Fed and at the American Securitization Forum, I just want to make sure I'm clear, that was with respect to countrywide originated loans.
It was with respect to countrywide loans. But one of the points that I made is countrywide really is the countrywide. It was simply a reflection of the entire market.
Sure, I just wanted to make
Because of the strategy that they pursued. But the advantage of using the countrywide database over the loan performance database is that there were better controls around it, more data in there. So it was a much more controlled laboratory than other data sources.
Sean, is it possible, or Mr. McMurray, do you still have copies of this research? I mean, we'd like to see it, the presentations and the research.
Sure.
That would be great.
If you could get that to us in the next week, that would be the most helpful. If that's possible. Thank you. You said the time period. What was the time period for your research? You said it was broad?
It covered quite a few years. I had done versions, and Sean and I will look at this, but probably the best, what I would encourage you to look at, was done late 05 and through 2006. And so we've got copies that, what we'll give you is the Fed presentation. I think we have the ASF. There was also presentations to countrywide investors, both fixed income and equity. And so we can send that to you. And it does cover, by the way, we split out because people are always interested in this, subprime from prime. And then also, importantly, you'll see home equity loans and closed-end fixed seconds, which in this particular cycle, the whole seconds issue has not had very much attention yet, and it desperately deserves more attention than it's getting.
Right.
You mean silence.
This is Sean. I should just interject that to the extent we have files and these presentations from John's personal collection or they're available publicly, I don't at this point have any objection to providing them, but to the extent we've seen these documents as a result of documents in other litigation, they may very well be covered by confidentiality or protective orders, so I'll have to look at that before I can produce anything.
Okay, just let us know if there are any issues on that, because I think we'll have pretty easy ways to work through them, but definitely let us know if those issues come up.
Right.
Mr. McMurray, would you... go ahead.
Most of the ones I'm thinking about were given publicly.
Great.
We'll double check.
Great. Is it possible for you to give us sort of the 2-minute high-level walkthrough of what the conclusions of your research were that would have been presented both to the Fed, the public, and to countrywide investors, and presumably senior management?
Absolutely. It identified and quantified the riskiness of various characteristics that would be associated or attributes with a loan. So things like FICO, and that we use that as a reference for the borrower's credit history, combined loan to value ratio, which is for leverage, documentation style, appraisal style, occupancy, purpose, whether it was a refinance, cash out refinance, a purchase loan transaction. So a whole series of geography, where the loan was originated, or where the property was located. So a whole series of things that, through the course of our research, that we had identified as being important in predicting how likely the borrower would be to become seriously delinquent, which is a precursor to default. And what you would see in this cycle is many loans had multiple high-risk characteristics on them. And that's whether they existed in the prime space, the Alt-A space, or the subprime space.
Were these your research findings ever presented to the rating agencies?
We shared when the rating agencies would come through and meet with Countrywide. We would share the various reports that we had at the time. Certainly.
Do you know if these specific reports were shared with the rating agencies?
I don't remember a specific meeting where they were, but I would be shocked if they had not been. Because again, the rating agencies would routinely make visits to Countrywide, and we would bring our standard sets of reports to them to show what we were seeing. Nobody's benefited, by the way, of just my personal belief on this, on any kind of asset securitization or sale. I think transparency is absolutely crucial, and to the extent that that gets compromised, everybody's going to get hurt, including the seller of those assets, ultimately.
Could you describe to what extent, if at all, this research was used and informed the underwriting standards that were employed by Countrywide on the front end of loan originations?
It was used in a couple of ways. So Countrywide had for their residential area an automated scorecard called Clues. They had an automated underwriting system called Clues, so it's similar to Fannie Mae's Desktop Underwriter or Freddie Mac's Loan Prospector. And so all three of those systems have a quantitative scorecard. So the way of developing that quantitative scorecard was very similar, if not essentially the same, as the type of research that we were presenting out. There were some nuanced differences, but basically the same technique. So it was used for that. The second way that I personally used it was to inform the policy debate. To put in front of senior management and others, here's what we're seeing. How should this affect what the guidelines should be? How should this affect our various policies?
When Countrywide sold loans to Fannie or Freddie, who knew more about those loans in terms of the comparable AUS systems?
Well, Fannie and Freddie were special cases for a lot of reasons. It's hard to say who knew more. Both Fannie and Freddie had very capable people. The techniques that I'm describing were used both at Fannie and Freddie. There were occasions where. I'm absolutely certain that this type of research was shared because I can personally remember instances. I can remember an instance where another gentleman and I went and met with Fannie Mae in their boardroom and talked about what we were seeing. In Freddie Mac's case, Don Bassinius and I would talk frequently. I can remember an occasion where we met for an entire day going over it. I can remember another occasion where he and his team were out in California, and I went through the same types of odds ratio analysis that I'm describing, and they were not in no instance were they surprised.
Okay.
So back to how your research informed sort of the underwriting standards, was there ever a time, or multiple times if there were, when you had research that showed these risk characteristics were such that we shouldn't be offering certain types of loans, or we shouldn't be offering certain types of loans to certain types of borrowers?
Or at a certain price.
Well, so problem that I had, there are lots of debates like that. The problem that I was up against is pr- prior to me ever landing at Countrywide, they had a corporate strategy in place called the matching strategy. Again, it gets back to this product menu idea. And so if another lender was offering a product out in the market, it was Countrywide's policy to match that product. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. So that just meant that you would offer the same product. But how would Countrywide find out about these? Would it be a borrower came in and said, you know, certain products are available, I can get this from another lender, but I'd like to get it from you? Or it was really more market-based research that you would find out what they were and they would be specific Countrywide offerings?
No, it was much more the latter case, where it was market. They had a very serious and well-staffed effort doing market-based research. It could come from the first source, but institutionally they had in place a group called Product Leadership, and one of the key charges of that was to determine how the Countrywide menu compared with other menus of products around the industry, and as I said, this corporate strategy was a matching strategy, so that anything somebody else was offering, that Countrywide would offer that as well, so that irrespective of where it was in the distribution channel, that a customer would not have to go elsewhere to get a product because Countrywide didn't offer it.
So that means they match price as well?
The price, that I'm not going to know quite as much about. They had a whole pricing strategy where, on a loan-by-loan basis, they could do some price matching. You know, I will say one of the other debates that I had with some of the people there was this idea of risk-based pricing, which I generally agree with, but risk-based pricing has limits to it's not going to be always effective. Now, there would be people that were at Countrywide and a lot of other places, by the way, that would disagree with me on that, but that was another point of hot debate as well.
So just a couple
just to finish that off, that the belief by some of the senior-most people at Countrywide was that the risk-based pricing would work in virtually every instance, and so, yes, some of these things are more risky, but we're also pricing for them.
Would you, when you say senior-most people, would you just clarify who exactly you're talking about?
Sure. So most of the debates would involve Dave Sample.
And his title was?
So he when I left Countrywide, he was the president and chief operating officer. For most of the time that I was at Countrywide, he ran the mortgage banking business and the broker-dealer business.
And he's one of the people who believed that risk-based pricing worked in almost every instance? Is that what you said?
This is my interpretation. I think the way I interpreted it is he would be one that thought it worked in every instance.
Okay. So if we could just get back, I just want to, just a couple of follow-up questions. First, and I'll ask them together to sort of let you know where I'm going. First, was there ever any exception to the matching strategy? Was there ever a product that Countrywide said, no, we won't offer this for the reasons that might have come from your risk analysis or otherwise? And then just to really sort of drive home a little bit more on my question of what you ever recommended they do based on your research and what response you got.
Sure. So several thoughts there. when Stan Kerlin was before Dave Sample became president, Stan Kerlin was president. So one of the concepts I developed for him was called the three R's: risk, return, and responsibility. So the idea behind these, and they were, I call them guiding principles for product offerings, but really my intent was for it to extend beyond that. And so the idea was, first off, for anything we're going to offer out in terms of a transaction that we do with whether it's an institutional customer or a consumer customer, we want to understand the key risks inherent in that transaction, make sure that those are all identified. The idea, and so that's the first R. The second R, return, is the idea that under no circumstances would it make sense to offer a transaction or a product that did not generate a positive return for the company. You know, the company was in business to make a profit for its shareholders, and so thinking about the return ahead of time was very important. And then third R was responsibility, and that's a responsibility to the customer, whether it's an institution or a consumer, the responsibility to shareholders, the responsibility to employees, the responsibility to regulators, that the product needed to be a responsible one. So we have that in place, although while Stan and I thought it was a good idea, it never got fully accepted at the company. Dave didn't like it, but we had it partially in place. And so let me just use an example. So hard money lending. So this is something that there were a number of other lenders offering out. And by hard money lending, what I'm referring to is you're simply looking at the collateral and as the source for repayment and not considering the borrower's ability to repay.
Okay.
In my opinion, that is not, it fails the, forget about the first two R's, it fails the third R in my opinion. It's probably not a responsible product to offer out, or it would be very difficult to do so responsibly. And so that's one that got heavily debated. And so it was. I think it may have been done ultimately in a minor way, but never in a big way because of this debate. So that would be an example of one that wasn't really done. There was another product match that.
Could I interject just for one moment? The concept of hard money lending that you describe, it sounds similar to a low documentation or no documentation loan, right? Where you would not have checked pay stubs and other indicia of a borrower's ability to repay the loan. Would your comment that this wasn't done in a large way extend to low documentation or no documentation loans?
No. So here you're bringing up a crucially important point. So I mean, can we go off on a tangent here?
Please.
Because this is important. So for documentation, there are three primary things that you're going to look at to document. Employment, income, and assets. So those are the three things you're going to look at documenting. There are a couple ways you could have what's considered full documentation, which you're getting verifications of employment, of deposit, and so forth. You can have alternative documentation where you're collecting pay stubs, brokerage statements, bank statements. So those I would consider full doc. The next version or the next notch away from that would be what I would call stated, which a lot of standard commercial bank and community bank products would fall into this category. That's where the borrower says what their employment is. That's what, and they say what they earn, or they say what assets that they have, but there's no documentation or verification done. And maybe in some cases there might be some verbal or phone verifications done. So that's stated doc. And then you could have no documentation loans. And then you can have versions of each. So a NINA would be a no income, no asset loan. So the income was neither stated nor verified. The assets were neither stated nor verified. You could have a NEVA, no income verified assets, so they didn't state or document the income, but they both stated and verified the assets. You could have a SEVA, and that, this was a very common loan out there. The income was stated but not verified. The assets were both stated and verified. And so the difference on hard money lending is, so let's take a NINA as an example. So no income, no asset, it wasn't verified or stated. You would still look at the borrower's FICO score, and typically they would have to have a fairly strong FICO score and able to carry off a NINA loan. What's different about hard money lending is oftentimes the borrower will have a very poor credit score, and so you're not looking at the credit score at all, really, but really on the just the property. So it's a long-winded answer, but
no, that was very helpful.
These distinctions are critical.
Right, and so just so I understand, and I'll let you continue going with sort of the earlier discussion, but just to be clear, that Countrywide did offer the full panoply of documented, stated doc, no doc loans.
They did, and there were two reasons for that. One is the matching strategy that I mentioned, and the other is an evolution, a part of Countrywide's evolution. So I know they're thought of as a subprime lender, but if I compare them, like a J.P. Morgan Chase where I worked, is certainly less of a subprime lender than J.P., certainly less of a subprime lender than Citi, certainly less of a subprime lender than Wells, because Countrywide got into that a little bit later and less of a big way. But let me describe what I mean by the evolutionary aspect. So on home equity loans are something that a lot of banks offered but that Countrywide had not traditionally offered. And home equity loans, this has changed a little bit as a result of the crisis, but traditionally those were really a stated income, stated asset type of a product. So the typical way a home equity loan line of credit would be done would not be the way a normal mortgage would be done, where all of the documentation would be collected. Well, the way Countrywide evolved through time is they were much more of a first lien lender where that documentation was collected. And so when they first started offering home equity loans, it was a natural thing just to collect the documents and doing things the way they would have done it for a first lien. And so their home equity line of credit product had both full doc and low doc, and what was maybe not fascinating to you, but was very fascinating to me from a scientific perspective is we had both versions in which to do these research on. If I compare that to WAMU, at WAMU, because they were more of a thrift is how they evolved, the home equity line of credit was more, you know, we're going to offer this just on a stated basis because that is the tradition in the markets. So another long-winded answer. So yes, Countrywide offered the whole panoply of mortgage products that were out there, and the reason was both because of the matching strategy and also because of the way they evolved versus some of the thrifts and commercial banks evolving differently.
Did Countrywide have an approach of selling a first loan and then a silent second?
Well, actually, Countrywide would have been one of the ones that did not have that approach. And so we tried to be, you know, what I observed at Countrywide is them trying to be very careful to pick up the seconds. And so particularly if Countrywide offered the second, it would be picked up and be part of that, be part of the data on that consumer. And that's if they were done at the same time. A few minutes ago, I talked about seconds being very important in this credit cycle. And part of the reason it was important is that people did not pay enough attention to seconds in most cases. And I would say, from the this is research I've done now on mostly more the loan performance database, which covers virtually every lender. Most lenders were not very careful about identifying those second liens, even if they were done at the same time. And so they would have ended up being silent. But the research that we did at Countrywide showed that that combined loan-to-value ratio is very important. How the borrower behaves is a function of their total leverage, not just the first lien, if there is a second lien in place.
We've heard stories of the first mortgage being offered at one point and then the second being offered slightly later, and that it wouldn't be picked up. Have you heard any of that?
I have heard that, and I believe in the industry that was probably a relatively prevalent practice. I'm going to go off on another tangent, and I apologize. You guys can stop me and bring me back. Something else, this wasn't done at Countrywide necessarily, but I've seen it at other lenders, even here in my work at the Home Loan Bank, where lenders would offer out second liens and not necessarily do a title search. And worse still, in some cases, it would be ostensibly a secured transaction, and they wouldn't record the second mortgage. If people don't look, if they don't properly record the mortgage or deeds of trust, I think everyone suffers. But both of those are things that I observe going out in the industry.
So
sorry for the tangent.
No, that's absolutely fine. Believe me, I'm sure there are questions that we will wish we would have asked and should have asked, and it's in your head and not ours, and so please feel free to do that where appropriate. I guess sort of my next question is really about the research that you've described seems to be about the risk characteristics of mortgages, and it sounds like this did engender some debate on different products within the company. And I think we can come back to that later if we have time in more detail. What I'm sort of curious about is, in your role as chief credit officer and then as chief risk officer, looking at the risk to the company that came from offering every loan product in the market and the types of mortgages that we all now know caused major issues in the housing market and the broader economy. I mean, what types of risk analyses were you doing for Countrywide as an enterprise? And were you finding things that gave you cause for concern?
So let me answer that. And Sean reminded me, I've given you an example or so of when it wasn't matched. But I'll come back to that because there are probably some more examples. But let's stay on this one. This is another important issue. So Countrywide's practice was, in addition, so they had the matching strategy, but another key strategy that they had was any product that was created needed to be created so that it could be sold into the capital markets. So one of the other big debates that we had, and actually in the public presentations that we'll get for you, I can show you some diagrams that I shared with folks on this.
That'd be great.
You can transfer. The risk could be transferred into the capital markets, but it was my belief that would never happen completely. There would always be some residual risk left in the firm. And so some of the presentations that I did to investors and internally, both, was to talk about depending on the type of execution, meaning the securitization or the other way that the product got put into the secondary market or the capital markets, how that would affect the amount and the type of risk that Countrywide retained on its balance sheet. So by and large, most of it, in theory, was transferred to the capital markets. If we go back to that 3R guiding principles that I told you, you know, my point and what I to the inside the company was, you know, that risk transfer was never going to be 100% complete for anything, and then secondly, even if it were, even if we got to a spot where we were comfortable with the risk, you've got the responsibility aspect. And so on that, and this is a question I pose to activists, regulators, anyone that would listen to me. So part of the responsibility is, what is an acceptable mortality rate? So all of these got the other aspect that I got beat up on was, look, you're being mean. You're trying to keep people out of houses by restricting the guidelines. And that wasn't my intent, but my question was simply, what's an acceptable mortality rate? So if we can quantify how many of the borrowers, you know, the percentage of borrowers we expect to default, where do you draw the line? Is a 10% expected default rate too high? 20? 50? I posed that question many, many times to anyone who would listen, and I never got an answer.
So what was your
view?
My answer, so the answer I proposed was around 19 or 20%, which had been the expected default rate on FHA loans. So FHA is a program that's been out there for a long time, kind of a 1 in 5 mortality rate. And then there wasn't anything scientific about that. It's just that, to me, that felt about right. And we tended to use that for our guiding principles, just because no one ever answered me. The various activist groups out there, they would tell me things like, "Well, we just want you to figure out exactly which borrowers are going to default. Just don't give them the loan," which is a ridiculous suggestion. If we knew that, we wouldn't, you know, life would be a lot easier in lending, but you don't know exactly which borrowers are going to default. And so then it's like a life insurance question where you're dealing with what's an acceptable mortality.
I mean, there are ways that you can get closer to the right answer, though, right?
Let's just say I've got 10 borrowers, all who have a 20% chance of defaulting. It's hard to distinguish which one. If they all come back with exactly the same probability of defaulting, you're not going to be able to pick between one or the others.
The whole
purpose of underwriting is partially to get at what that probability is, but you're not going to say with certainty ahead of time, yes, this guy's, he's going to be the one that's the default, and this guy isn't.
I think what I'm understanding you to say, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because when I first thought I was hearing, and maybe this is just, well, anyway, what I first thought I was hearing was 19 to 20%, it's acceptable if we shoot for 19 to 20% of our loans defaulting. And now what I think I'm hearing you say is, on an individual basis, from an underwriting perspective, if there's a 19 or 20% probability that this person is going to default, then that gets through our system. That or a less probability gets through our system?
Yeah, they're similar. They're very similar concepts. So 19% is that's where I would draw the line on whether or not to offer. You know, if the expected default rate on a product were higher than that, I personally would start to get concerned with, gosh, are we really doing the responsible thing for the borrower? If we know 1 out of 5 are going to end up in default, that's about as high as I think that it should be. personally. That's just John's personal opinion. What I was trying to explain is some people have this idea that ahead of time you're going to know with certainty who will and who will not default. And you will never know that with certainty. And the reason is people get divorced. One of the spouses dies. They lose their job. There's all kinds of things that happen to them that you can't predict. You will know from a probabilistic standpoint who is more likely to default than, between one borrower or another, but you're not going to know with certainty ahead of time exactly which loans are going to default.
What house price... Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, so I was going to say, that was the pushback from some of the activists. It's just like trying to figure out exactly which individual people are going to default and don't give them the loan. And you can't do that. Sorry about that, but you had a house price question.
Yeah, what was your house price assumption to get to the 19%?
Well, the way you would, there's several ways of doing this, and so the publicly shared studies that we'll get for you, house prices at the MSA or CBSA level were a time-varying, time-dependent covariate is what it's called, and so it's a variable that changes through time, and so that's an important thing to include in the model, in my opinion. And then the next question, as soon as you put that in the model, the next question is, okay, what value do you put in there? Do you put in a long-term average, which has been 3 or 4%, or do you put something else in? That's not a easy question to answer. The Countrywide practice was generally to put in what the long-run average was.
So that was sort of your 3 to 4% appreciation as an assumption.
Exactly. Most institutions, by the way, didn't even have home prices in the model. So for a while, Countrywide didn't either, and that's how things evolved. They probably had it in sooner than others did. There is a whole write-up on home prices that I can email to you that I have out there.
That would
publicly, because that's another thing that gets me crazy is the home price thing, that people aren't paying enough attention to that.
Yeah, no, we'd really appreciate that. One of the other questions I had in terms of, if we could just stay for 1 second on the assumptions that goes into the 19 to 20% default rate, how did you deal with correlation risk? So, for example, what I'm specifically thinking about is, maybe it's not as correlated if you're looking at 80% LTV, FICO score above 660. I mean, I'm just making stuff up versus how correlated the expectation of default is when you are giving no documentation loans and things like that. Option arms, negative amortizing.
Yeah, that's a good question, too. So that study, the research that I talked about, gets it precisely at that. So what you're able to do is isolate out each variable individually and look at it and quantify it, and then you can assemble everything back together, so it explicitly takes those types of things into account.
So did Countrywide take those things into account when it was underwriting loans?
Yeah, it was baked right into the quantitative scorecard that was part of Clues.
I guess I don't know. Okay.
What was baked in? We're not quite clear. You understand that we don't.
What she's referring to is correlation. So the effect of these various variables on the likelihood of default.
But what did you, as the question, for example, did you assume that low docs and no docs might have a different correlation from a standard prime loan? Just that kind of question.
Absolutely. And I would call it a different coefficient is the exact term, but yes.
Who would
so you have two identical loans, in every respect, except let's suppose the only difference, one is low doc and one is full doc. That low doc is going to have a higher default probability. And by the way, and it's not going to be a smaller, it's going to be a, like a 2 times or 3 times more likely to default, just with that one difference by itself.
Right. Now, you said that, you know, and that you felt that a default rate between 19 and 20% was somewhere around right on a new product. What was kind of management's viewpoint on this? Like, do you remember any products being approved that were higher than your 19 and 20% threshold?
I do believe there were some that were through that threshold. Yeah, that was just my personal view.
Right.
A lot of the subprime, depending on the particular combination of attributes. So let's say you had a subprime product. Depending on how the various factors that you all just described. You know, what were present in an individual loan, you know, might have taken, you know, part of the product through that threshold. But this was a very controversial proposal or guiding principle that I had. So it was, I would say, by and large, it wasn't accepted either inside the company or outside the company.
I mean,
and keep in mind, you guys have asked about the underwriting and so forth. Remember that Countrywide's second key strategy or principle, so first was matching, but the other is there had to be someone in the capital markets willing to buy it. So a lot of the underwriting guidelines, the specific requirements were dictated by the capital markets and not by Countrywide.
Can I ask you a follow-up question? So, yeah, did you see a difference in the kind of underwriting standards for loans that were going to be sold to the capital markets versus loans that were going to be maintained on Countrywide's books? Was there a difference in, or did you guys look at that or performance?
Yeah, no, so that's another great question. So the way Countrywide did it, everything was put together to be sold into the capital markets. There was some debate. The offering stuff that couldn't be sold and then kept on the books, although that never really gained traction. What Countrywide sought to do to keep on the books was to pick loans they thought were better from an investment perspective, including risk perspective, to retain on their books in their bank, as an example. So everything would be originated so that it could be sold into the capital markets. But then the bank, as an example, would pick which loans it wanted to keep on its balance sheet as a subset of what was going to get sold, what would have been otherwise sold into the capital markets. Does that answer your question?
I guess just to clarify what you're saying, it sounds like there would be one set of underwriting guidelines that Countrywide would apply, and then all of the loans that were originated that satisfied those guidelines, out of those, the best ones would be kept by Countrywide. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That's a fair way of stating it. The way it was implemented was a little more complicated, and I can describe that to you if you want.
Please do.
But from a strategy standpoint, that is the way it worked. Yes.
Okay. If you could explain it in a little more detail, that would be great.
Sure. So, and here I've used the concept of a Russian doll. Have you seen the nested Russian dolls that fit within one another?
Yes.
So there was one set of guidelines that Countrywide had that were worked out with investors in the capital market, the capital markets broadly, because it would have included the rating agencies, the investor community, and so forth. Those tended to be the broadest. There was another set of guidelines that would have been narrower than that. And that would have been what Countrywide used for origination purposes. And the reason for doing that was to Countrywide had a very elaborate exception management process, and so that the purpose of those two guidelines was to facilitate the exception processing. And then at the bank, we had a narrower set of guidelines still, but that was to make to put into effect the selection strategy. So in other words, for a long time, Countrywide didn't want anything in the bank where the FICO was on the borrower was worse than 660. So that would be an example of the third set of guidelines.
When would that have changed? You said for a long time.
Those were looked at constantly. I don't remember when that particular one changed. And keep in mind from a risk perspective, and even more so from an investment perspective, any one of these, so FICO is an example, very important from a credit perspective, but it also affects prepayments, and prepayments are a crucial risk item for a mortgage as well. So if you simply selected the very best credit loans, those would also tend to be the very riskiest loans from a prepayment and an interest rate risk perspective. And so Countrywide, for what was kept in the bank, tried to take into account as complete a view of risk as possible and pick the loans that had the most favorable risk return attributes. But it, at some point, that 660 floor, which was probably too simplistic of a screen, was replaced with something more sophisticated.
And who was the head of the bank during this? What time period are we roughly are we talking about, and who was the head of the bank?
Well, Carlos Garcia was the bank chairman, and Jim Purash was the bank president, kind of all during this time. The investment strategy from the bank's perspective mostly would have been led by Mike Muir, who was either the chief investment officer or the chief financial officer, depending on the time frame.
Mike Muir, okay.
And so, sorry, for these three sets of guidelines, the first one, it was just there was one set that you developed based on conversations input from the investor community, so that would presumably include the people who were buying Countrywide loans to securitize them, as well as the rating agencies. And what?
That's right. And keep in mind, the guidelines wouldn't have appeared as three sets of guidelines. This, I'm just describing this. That's what exists in the Countrywide system to put into place that strategy, both the exception processing strategy and the bank investment strategy is why there were three sets of guidelines. What the investing community would have seen is the broader set. The origination group would have seen the one that was just narrower than that. And then the set for the bank was just as a way to narrow down the population of loans which they were allowed to select from.
Is there a way to quantify, like if we were looking for documents to support that separation in three categories, did you guys look at anything like that, or how would we kind of get to the loan profile? Is it just simply like looking at what's on the bank's books versus what's looking at
yeah. Were there written underwriting policies?
Right. Yeah, of course, yes. Yeah, there absolutely were written underwriting policies, and those were maintained electronically. But yes, they were in writing. Kind of another important thing we ought to talk about. There's guidelines, but the other. Where the rubber really meets the road are the actual attributes of the loans that were originated. And so you could have a set of guidelines, but you don't know till the loans are actually originated exactly really what you have.
Go ahead.
So I want to draw that distinction. People get way off in the weeds on the whole guideline thing. And they're missing like what was actually and why this is I don't know. All along throughout this process, forget the guidelines. People could have just looked at what was actually being originated. They could have looked at the loan performance database, updated every month. They could have looked at the prospectuses. Again, every month new prospectuses coming out. They could have looked at the Fannie and Freddie disclosures on their new pools, which were coming out every month. So that's actually what was really happening. The guidelines are just simply that. They're guidelines on what was possible to be originated, not necessarily what was being originated.
And I guess that's another question we have. So you've got these guidelines, and then how were exceptions to the guidelines made? Was there a specific process in place that had to be followed? Who had discretion to grant exceptions from the guidelines?
So there was a specific process in place. Countrywide had a very elaborate approach for handling exceptions. At most places that I've observed, there might have been exceptions, but the infrastructure wouldn't even be there to be able to identify stuff as exceptions in a lot of cases.
Can you describe the procedures that Countrywide had in place and how you were able to track the exceptions?
Sure. So I'll describe some of the things that Countrywide had. So they had, as part of CLUES, the automated underwriting system, they had another subsystem called Mustang, which was a rule set. So all of the guidelines plus a lot of other rules were contained in that rule set. And so as a loan was coming through the origination process, it would be bounced up against that rule set, and any kind of discrepancies would be noted. And the advantage of that is it's much more thorough than what you'd have if you were depending on a human underwriter to identify all of the rules, which typically are going to number into the hundreds if it's done thoroughly. And so at most lenders, there could have been a loan coming through that would have generated some discrepancies, but if they didn't have that type of an automated system, it would just pass through the system without ever being caught.
So these discrepancies were identified before a loan was approved?
That's right. Okay. And Countrywide had, for each of its distribution channels, an exception desk that was charged. And it was part of the production channels that was charged with approving the exceptions. And there typically would be a risk-based pricing adjustment depending on what the exception was.
But were exceptions always approved? Just with a different price put on them?
I would say, in my opinion and observation, yes, they generally were. I mean, one of the things I would caution you guys against, everyone instantly says, lots of exceptions, bad. The thing that Countrywide has done a bad job is explaining, I mean, they had a great system for identifying it. I mean, so one of the analogies I use is blood pressure. So if you've got a tool to take blood pressure, you can figure out who has high blood pressure and who doesn't. If you don't have the tool at all, you could have another population where the attributes of the loans are just as bad, or there are still people in the population with high blood pressure, but because the tools weren't there to identify those people, it goes without notice and everything is okay. Which leads me back to, it's not the fact that it was an exception that was important, it's look at the attributes on the loans.
But earlier...
That's what matters. If the guidelines and the exceptions, yes, those are going to affect to some degree what was originated, but what really made the difference is what was originated.
But the exceptions seem to play a crucial part in what was originated, because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like if I'm trying to approve someone for a loan and an exception comes back, like, normally the process would be that loan gets denied because they haven't met the criteria in the system. But then if you kick it up to the exception desk says, well, let's give it to them, but let's charge them a little more interest rate, right?
I agree with you. The point that I'm making is that a lot of other places, it wouldn't have even been identified. identified as an exception.
But it might
have. So it still would have gone through. It still would have been approved. It just wouldn't have. It never would have had the second look.
Did Countrywide generate reports on the performance of exception loans?
They were absolutely.
That was
generated, but again, I take you back to the other thing that's more important is the performance of the actual attributes on the loan. An exception is like high blood pressure. It's simply where you're drawing the line at any one point in time to saying what is or what's not high blood pressure.
Well, so
the actual number of the blood pressure is more meaningful.
Sure. Correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like you indicated that you had concerns about the matching strategy. And so my question is whether or not reports generated about the loans originated under that strategy through the exception desk performed worse as a whole than loans originated according to Countrywide's standard guidelines. I mean, how would you analyze the effectiveness or the riskiness of the matching strategy without kind of tracking the products that were generated under that strategy?
You got several questions in there, so let's dissect them a little bit. First off, Countrywide had reams and reams of reports that looked at these issues, so extensive reporting. On the exceptions, it's going to be, by definition, a higher risk population. So again, sticking with the blood pressure analogy, so let's say we're going to draw an arbitrary line on what we think is high blood pressure. Anyone above that line is going to be considered high blood pressure. They're going to have a higher mortality rate. And so the same thing on exceptions, they're going to be, by definition, loans that are higher risk simply because they're above this arbitrary boundary. So yes, that was looked at and presented in credit risk committee meetings as an example. I cautioned people at the time, and I'm going to caution you guys now, just simply trying to jump to a conclusion on exceptions is a shortcut. You're better off looking at what the attributes of the loans actually were to try to understand, you know, exactly what aspect was causing the performance to be either better or worse than expected.
Sure.
So that's all. But yes, there's all kinds of reports that looked at those issues.
Okay.
We take your point about looking at loan attributes, but we'd still like to ask you a few more questions about this exception process, just so we can understand how it worked. What percentage of Countrywide's loans that were originated were in line with the guidelines, and what percentage were exceptions to the guidelines?
You know, I don't remember that number off the top of my head. There were a significant, and by significant, maybe it's a couple percent, maybe it's 10. I don't remember the exact number that would be classified as an exceptions. But again, I'm going to caution you guys again. You need to be careful. If you took another lender's loans and ran them through the Countrywide system, you'd probably end up with a similar exception rate.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that it didn't show up elsewhere is just they didn't have the tools to catch it.
But it sounds like you think the exception rate was closer to like the 10% range rather than 50-60% range.
And I don't remember exactly, and I suspect that it's going to be very uneven depending on the product category. Where what would be an exception or not an exception is an arbitrary boundary, though.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't necessary. And again, that's why I described the several sets of guidelines. So it might have been an exception for origination processes, but not from, you know, capital markets processes. So it's just simply a way to organize what was being originated into different modes of being processed.
Well, it may be arbitrary, but if you had the guidelines, I guess maybe you can tell us a little more about the thought process that went into putting these guidelines in place, because if you think this is a good guideline, then it would seem to me that the exceptions, you had to draw a line somewhere, but they may not be so... Why would they be arbitrary if you think you had good guidelines to begin with?
What's a good guideline?
Well, going back
how did Countrywide determine what these guidelines should be and what they thought was appropriate?
Well, the company strategy ties back to what I described to you at kind of the beginning of the call. So two major aspects. One was the matching strategy. So what were competitors offering? And then that was intersected with what could be sold into the capital markets. So those two factors those are what drove the guidelines. But let's just stay on that. What's a good guideline or not? So a low down payment, is that a good guideline? I'm mostly a risk and investment guy, and so I would tell you no, it's a horrible guideline. I don't like it, so I would say not a good guideline.
So who at Countrywide, I'm sorry to interrupt, but could you just tell us who at Countrywide had the responsibility for this? Because I want to make sure we've gotten your opinion on some things, and then you've come back later and said that wasn't actually Countrywide's policy, that's just what you thought it should be. And I just want to make sure we're clear on, as we go through this description, who actually had responsibility for setting these guidelines, as opposed to sort of like what would be good in an ideal risk management from an ideal risk management perspective, and we're interested in both. I just want to make sure I'm clear in understanding lines of responsibility here.
Sure. So let me just finish off the good and bad. So low down payment may be good or bad. It depends on your perspective. It's good if you're trying to get people into houses. A low down payment is good. I mean, the FHA program is an example. It's built around a low down payment. So, again, it's hard to say whether a guideline is good or bad. It all depends on your perspective. So that's the point I was trying to make there. On the question that you just asked, there were two longstanding corporate strategies that were in place long before I got there. The first was the matching strategy, where they were matching what competitors were offering out in the market, and then secondly, that had to be saleable into the capital markets. So Countrywide did have a process in place to evaluate whether or not a particular product met those two criteria before it could be rolled out to the not just to the public, it could be to institutional customers or consumer customers. But that was the way, at least, that Countrywide did it in a controlled fashion. I mean, ultimately, it would have been Dave, meaning Dave Samble, he could have said something was either a go or a no-go. So he would have been the one ultimately responsible.
So that's on the product, whether the product is going to be offered from the two, whether it meets the two criteria. Whose job was it to set underwriting standards that went into the CLUES system, et cetera?
So there were multiple people involved in that. When I arrived at Countrywide, I didn't like the scorecard, and so I redid that, but that was a little bit under the radar, and Dave wasn't happy about that.
When you say you redid the scorecard, what are you referring to?
The quantitative scorecard that was part of CLUES we re-estimated the equations and added more variables to it.
So you did that of your own volition?
I did that of my own volition, and we were able to get that in. And then subsequently, when we updated it, it was more of a multi-area approach, where it would have included people from the production division, meaning the sales side, along with the bank and people from the centralized risk area, which was my area.
I guess the reason I'm asking is that a lot of banks have quote unquote underwriting departments. And, I mean, I was just wondering if there was a department at Countrywide whose job it was to take individual products being offered and establish what the underwriting criteria was going to be for that product.
Well, Countrywide did have an underwriting department, as do most lenders. But there's a piece of this that I think I'm not doing a good job explaining. For Countrywide and most other lenders, the guidelines are going to be a function of what can be sold into the capital markets, and not something that Countrywide comes up with.
One of the things we've heard is that, you know, capital markets were paying more money for no doc, subprime, or like all, let's say, riskier loans than they were paying for prime loans. Did you experience that? Is that kind of, am I getting closer to what you're, is that how pricing was kind of set? Were you getting those kind of signals from the market, or?
The short answer is yes, but we should drill into that a little more. But I want to be sure I've done a decent job explaining this whole guideline thing.
Well, we still
the guidelines are primarily going to be a function of what someone else is offering and what can be put into the capital markets.
Well, we understand how you've described the guidelines are generated, but there must be someone at Countrywide who set these guidelines. I mean, who wrote them down, who issued them, who circulated them to the employees and said, these are our underwriting guidelines.
As I described a minute ago, there was a whole process for that that involved multiple departments, but when you use the verb set, that sounds like that it was done in a vacuum, or that Countrywide was determining these, and the only... What I was trying to explain, it was mostly taking in what the capital markets would permit, as well as what some other lender or lenders were offering, and the intersection of those two was what was used to feed into the process that I was describing. But there would be multiple departments involved with converting what was pulled in from the market into Countrywide's systems and infrastructure.
How this comports with this responsibility.
So I just want to make sure that I understand. Countrywide did not have its own guidelines. Countrywide simply took market indicators of what it could sell, and then so it basically didn't set any limits on itself in terms of what is prudent underwriting standard. It would simply look to see what it could sell in the market, and that's what it originated.
I'm still not doing a great job of explaining this. The two primary inputs were the matching strategy and what could be sold into the capital markets.
And it had to meet both those criteria, correct?
It had to meet both those criteria. So that was the starting point. There were a lot of other things that had to be done before Countrywide would adopt those as their guidelines.
Okay, and then you described a process that several different departments were involved in. Was there one department or one officer or person who had the responsibility to coordinate that process?
Probably, I would say product leadership would be the one that was coordinating that, which was part of the production function. And I just want to weave a couple other things together to make sure I'm doing a good job explaining.
Who was head of product leadership while you were there? Who was the person?
I'm sorry?
Who was in charge of product leadership while you were there?
Ryan Kelbs was in charge of it for some of the time. Rick Bright would have been in charge of it prior to Ryan Kelbs.
And who was in charge of the exceptions desk while you were there?
There was a separate exception desk for each of the distribution channels. So for the consumer markets division, for the wholesale division, for the correspondent lending division, they would have each had a separate individual responsible for that desk. And then secondary marketing also had an exception desk as well.
So can you give us?
I want to be sure. Pardon me?
Oh.
I want to be sure I've woven some of the other things that we've talked about together. So that three R's that I talked about, that guiding principles that I came up, I mean, in the process of looking at these guidelines that came in, that met the two conditions, that's where we would have applied that. You know, as I explained, that was never completely accepted by the entire company, although we still tried to apply that particular set of principles. But in this process that I'm describing, where we would look at the guidelines, that's where that would have occurred.
I've got a question.
Part of the other aspect of implementing the guidelines is just making sure the computer systems, so that rule set that I talked about, that could be programmed in. The various specific documents that would be required for a product, that would have to be considered, because that was all done in an automated fashion. Another important point on the exceptions is a lot of the exceptions that were generated weren't necessarily because they were outside of guidelines. It was because the computer systems and other infrastructure where those guidelines would ultimately be reflected could not necessarily keep up with the marketing effort, and so loans would have to be handled through the exception process even though they complied with the guidelines that had been approved. And so those loans would be flagged as exceptions, but solely for the reason that I just described. It's just because the computer system hadn't caught up to where the product offerings at. And so that was a constant issue at Countrywide.
So it sounds like the guidelines would be updated based on product offerings, but there was a lag in the time that those guideline updates were actually reflected in your computer monitoring system.
I want to be careful with the use monitoring.
Or,
monitoring,
sorry,
no.
The clues database.
Yeah, to be fully reflected in the origination infrastructure. So that rule set is an example. Any of the attributes in the loans could be monitored. It's just where you're drawing the boundaries so that the let's say a guideline was widened, which was happening in a lot of cases. So a guideline was widened. That was approved. It would still be kicked out as an exception, even though it met the widened guideline, just because the rules database, the programming, and other changes to that hadn't been made yet. And so, I just want to be careful that was included in what would have been caught in the exception net.
I have two questions, please. One, you said you had one set of guidelines for capital markets. Was there a separate set of guidelines for sale to Fannie and Freddie?
Yeah, of course, because again, and I should ever have called them guidelines, because that seems to be such a catchword. Call it a set of specifications or boundaries, but absolutely, again, it was the intersection of what was being offered by others and then where it was going to go in the capital markets. And so things that were eligible for sale to Fannie or Freddie would have had that those guidelines would be a function of what Fannie or Freddie were willing to accept at any particular point in time.
Okay. Second question, without getting into the difference between Fannie Freddie guidelines and the others, you mentioned tolerating a 19% mortality rate, but not higher than that. That's fair, right? How do you price risk?
Be careful. It's fair. It's just John's opinion.
Okay.
I never got an answer from anyone on that, inside or outside the company.
But
what was Countrywide's? Tolerance?
They had one. They did not have one. That's what I'm saying to you. That was what I proposed. That's what I proposed to anyone and everyone inside and outside the company we use that as a placeholder, but no one's ever answered that for me.
No, I appreciate that. I do want to.
That's just my opinion. I just wanted to be clear on that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Just want to make sure that we did ask a couple of questions about, for example, home price appreciation assumptions and correlation assumptions. And I believe you said that those were tweaked in the model for different products to get to the acceptable expected default rate. So if that was, there must have been one that Countrywide used in its underwriting system. I'm assuming, yes or no?
Well, you got several things to dissect there, and I wanted to make sure I'm answering your colleague's question too, because he started to go down a path.
I think we need to clarify this because I think it's unclear from our discussion before.
And I'm going to attempt to do that. So the 19% had to do with the three R's that I described to you, and for product offering guidelines. Separate and apart from that. So let's put that to the side for a minute. That's getting at guidelines. That's getting at products. In the CLUES underwriting system itself, there were a set of rules and there was a quantitative scorecard. Those quantitative scorecards would have cutoffs as well. And there, what we tended to use was what that scorecard was predicting is the likelihood of a serious delinquency, say the chances of a 90-day delinquent occurring over some time frame, so in the first couple years of the loan's life. And so for the purposes of the CLUES underwriting scorecard, that is what was used, and there was a whole process for calibrating where that cutoff would be. It's going to be highly related to what the ultimate default rate would be, but again, those scorecard cutoffs, that was a separate process.
Okay. So the CLUES scorecard was not the expected default. It was whether there would be a serious delinquency within the first 2 years, as defined.
Yeah,
the percentage for what an expected serious delinquency in the first 2 years would be, what was the percentage cutoff? Was it 19% or was it some other number?
No, give me a chance here. The 19% was on the three R's. It was for on the scorecard cutoffs. That was on the idea. There was on ability to pay. So a similar idea. And so no one was rejected outright if they failed that cutoff. It would be shunted out for manual underwriting.
I think he just means that.
I don't remember exactly what the percentage mapped to. Would have been different, I suspect, for HELOCs versus other prime type of loans, which would include it all day. On subprime, a quantitative scorecard wasn't used. It was purely a rules driven.
It's not in the model.
A rules driven approach.
Okay, so there was no sort of quantified acceptable or not acceptable expected serious delinquency.
No, not a hard and fast, but the scorecards were looked at carefully as one of the things that was negotiated with Fannie and Freddie, because they accepted the Countrywide scorecard as their own, and so it was making sure. It's a way of ranking the loans that the loans that needed manual underwriting were culled out of the population, and only the ones that clearly had a ability to pay were approved from the quantitative scorecard's perspective. But I don't remember exactly what that translated into as a bad rate. I mean, it's Countrywide has, or Bank of America has, that documentation, I would expect, somewhere.
Let me ask the question differently and then go back to my original question. In terms of a risk officer's function, one of the theories is that the risk officer has a dialogue with company management about what they call risk appetite. And then the risk officer helps to translate that, working with the business unit, into reality. And I think what we're trying to ask here is, if your 19% number was not accepted as the upper bound, what was the risk appetite at Countrywide, and how was that articulated to you?
So the risk appetite discussions did occur, but we're completely whiffing a gigantic point here. That 19% gets at the responsibility aspect, and so I personally believe there's a risk dimension to that, but the whole idea of the risk that Countrywide faced, we've got to bring in what was being done with those loans, how they were being securitized, which were kept, which were not. So there were detailed discussions both with management and the board, at least that I was part of, that laid all that out. But we can't just look at guidelines. We can't just look at 19%. We're just scratching the surface if we're trying to get at the risk appetite question.
All right, let me ask one question first and then maybe try to double back to risk appetite.
Okay.
And that is, if you have a pool of loans and they have an average default rate of 19%, how do you price that?
Well, that's a great question, and it's going to get to this whole risk appetite question. So, I mean, and this isn't the first time that I've struggled explaining this, but a lot of the view is the loans are just going to stay on Countrywide's balance sheet, and in that case, how it would be priced would be very straightforward. For most of what Countrywide did, though, that's not what happened. The loans were put into some kind of a securitization. And so the key aspects of where that would price is where the various loans, if they were sold as whole loans or securities, could be sold, at what price those were at. That would be the main criteria. So let's just, I want to stay with this for a second, so let's just use Fannie or Freddie as an example. So the loans are going to be put into one of their securitizations, so it would be the price that Fannie or Freddie charged for their guarantee fee. It would also be the price that investors were willing to pay for Fannie or Freddie securities. Where the default probability would factor in here is in a fairly minor way. There's what's called rep and warranty risk. And so if a loan is more likely to default, you're more likely to see a rep and warranty claim. So you could reflect that in an aspect of pricing, but it's going to be a very tiny piece of the pricing puzzle. Most of the pricing is going to come from what investors will pay for those securities and what Fannie or Freddie were charging in guarantee and other fees.
Okay.
And we can go through a private label example too. So it didn't matter so much what Countrywide thought the default rate was going to be, but rather what Fannie or Freddie thought it was going to be, or in the case of private label securities, what the investors thought it would be.
Okay, so this helps a lot, because that means it doubles back to what you said. Your 19% was a responsibility issue that, you know, at that point you may be hurting more borrowers than you want to be hurting if they default. But it wasn't really a problem except for what could be put back to Countrywide in terms of risk, because you were offloading the risk, and the filters that would come into play for purchases for the bank on balance sheet would be a lot tighter than that.
Exactly, yes.
Okay. And how different were the criteria that Fannie and Freddie used from those for a PLS, for example?
They were fairly different. If we go back to, say, 2003, there was a good size difference. Over time, they moved closer and closer together. A lot of the volume that Fannie and Freddie would have or market share that they would have had was being eroded away and going to the private label market. And so they widened their guidelines in response.
When would that be?
That would have happened continuously during the early and mid 80s.
90s? You don't mean 80s, right?
I'm sorry. The early and mid 2000s. I apologize. I'm back at the beginning of my career instead of the 2000 cycle. So say from like 02 on is when that evolution was occurring.
Okay. Interesting.
But it was a huge issue, and as I mentioned to you guys, I came from Freddie Mac, so know those guys reasonably well. So it was something that they were grappling with, because they were taking on the risk. So while Countrywide and some of the other Wells, some of the other big lenders were selling this risk at market, Fannie Mae was taking it in. Freddie Mac was taking it in.
There's a New York Times article that talks about a meeting that is supposed to have taken place between Angelo Mozzillo and Dan Mudd when he came in as CEO of Fannie Mae, in which the essence was, and let me just represent this, that Mr. Mozzillo said to Mr. Mudd, "We've been selling all our good stuff to you and our bad stuff to Wall Street, and Wall Street's getting tired of that, so either you got to take all of our stuff, or that's really unacceptable." Did you perceive any changes in behavior around 05, 06 in terms of what you could sell to Fannie or Freddie, for that matter?
So I read the article as well. I wasn't in attendance in that meeting, but the short answer is yes. It wasn't a hard and fast switchover, though. That evolution was already underway by the time that meeting was supposedly took place.
Okay.
But I do think the pace quickened, but it wasn't, like I said, it didn't seem to me to be a switch where they instantly agreed to do it, but just rather more of an evolution through time.
I have some general risk officer questions, but let me defer to my colleagues here first.
I guess I have one question that's not a sort of like directly related to your risk officer function as well, and that is, if we perceive in looking at the loans that Countrywide originated over time, sort of from early 2000s to the later 2000s, and we perceived a deterioration in underwriting standards, would that be attributable, based on our earlier discussions, to deteriorating underwriting standards and what the market would bear? And a second and related question is whether you perceived Countrywide's underwriting standards deteriorating for loans that it held in portfolio at the same time that underwriting standards for all originations more broadly deteriorated.
So the standards widening, and I would use the word deterioration too, so I agree with you on that. While it was happening, the pushback I always got is we're trying to get more people into homes, and so don't call it a deterioration, just making the underwriting, quote, better. But I agree with the way you described it.
Okay.
And so yes, the reason why, if you looked at the attributes of the loans that Countrywide was originating, the attributes would be becoming riskier through time, and that is a function of the guidelines becoming wider through time. And the guidelines were becoming wider through time for two reasons. First and foremost, the competitive dynamic that I described, and then Countrywide's longstanding strategy of matching what the competitors were offering. And then secondly, and still very important, what the capital markets were willing to accept. And this would be both loan buyers, security buyers, bond insurance companies, mortgage insurance companies, Fannie, Freddie, so the buyers of risk, were widening what they would accept as well. And so that widening that was happening in the primary markets and in the secondary capital markets were responsible, I think, for the deterioration in the attributes for what Countrywide and the whole industry was originating.
And then to the second part of my question about what Countrywide held in portfolio?
So on that, that was another area of hot debate. It did tend to widen out through time, not nearly as drastically as what was going on in the market as a whole. There was an enormous fight. I'll call it. I don't want to call it a fight. A debate inside of Countrywide on option arms. That was one of the primary products that the bank held in its portfolio. And just a quick bit of history here. When I arrived at Countrywide, the two loan products that they emphasized in their loan portfolio were option arms and home equity lines of credit. And one of the main reasons that was done was because the interest rate risk was the lowest on those two products. And so we can spend more time on that, I suppose, if you want. But
no, that's not necessary at this point, thanks.
Okay, the big debate, though, on a couple of us, and I would have been one of the ones that was advocating that Countrywide Bank lessen its exposure to option arms. So there was a big debate on that, and this would have been, I think, in 06. So the chief investment officer for the whole company and I were advocating that we lessen the exposure to option arms. The bank wanted to increase its exposure to option arms, and so there was an intense debate. So you get to your question on risk appetite. You know, what is the company willing to accept from a risk appetite perspective? And so that was being brought up and debated, and ultimately the decision was made to continue the option arm exposure, but to purchase mortgage pool insurance for those loans to the extent possible.
Who did you primarily purchase that insurance from?
It was my recollection was General Electric which actually they spun that off. It was General Electric's mortgage insurance company and Radian. Would have been the primary two. There might have been a third, but my recollection, the primary two were Radian and GE.
Thank you.
Now, you said there was internal debate. Were there any like presentations to the board regarding this, or any kind of formal presentations you remember making along with the CIO concerning this?
I don't remember. There were a lot of presentations that were made at the and meetings that were held on this. The bank's exposure to option arms, including whether or not we had insurance on it, would have been taken up by the credit committee and the board at the bank level. And then there was also a credit committee at the holding company level where we had a lot of directors that were both on the bank board and the holding company board. So that would have been a topic that would have come up there as well.
What was the time frame of these debates?
On this particular one, my recollection is around 2006, in or around 2006.
Okay.
Sure. So, I mean, from documents that we have, you look from March 03 to, you know, it seems like options arm, you know, in March 03 there were less than 1% of the business that you guys were doing, and then it peaks at 25% in June 05 of what Countrywide was doing. Was there a kind of a shift in the marketing of that product, and you know, what would explain that increase?
Well, I think in prior to 03, Countrywide didn't have the product on its menu at all. Uh-huh. And so that is the explanation of why it was so low going into 03. And so in 03, it was being rolled out in the various origination channels. It's a complicated product to originate, and so there are a lot of lenders that never were able to gain the capability of originating it. But it became a very popular product in the industry, and Countrywide was one of the ones that was able to offer it in all their origination channels.
Was there any thought given to the problem of the reset of the, you know, the 228s and all that? Did you analyze that or do any kind of analysis of that?
Well, the 228s and 327s are actually a different product than option arms.
Okay.
But the answer to your question is yes, there was lots of thought and analysis done around the reset issue. If you looked at the product books that we generated and every month, we had analyses that were in those product books.
They were first in
which, you know, certainly shared with the board, the regulators, so there was lots of discussion and analysis around that particular issue.
Would you hold those on your books, or would you send those into the secondary market?
Well, most of the option arms were sent into the secondary market. As I mentioned before, the bank, that was one of the main portfolio products for the bank, so they did select a portion of what was originated for their portfolio. It tended to be what they thought were the better loans, but most were still sold to the secondary market on the option arms. On the 228 and 327, that particular product type is really a subprime product type, and so that would have been sold into the market. So Countrywide did not hold subprime loans on its balance sheet. WaMu did, by the way, so just a difference in strategy there. Now, on a subprime securitization, a residual is created. So just to kind of the theme that I mentioned before, you can sell most of the risk into the secondary or into the capital markets through this cycle, but, you know, I always maintain that not all of it could be sold. So in the form of a residual, Countrywide kept some of the risk on the 228 and 327.
Is that because of the putback option?
No, it was because of what's called a residual. Now, the putback option is the rep and warrant risk that I mentioned before. And in some of these investor presentations, I had a diagram, a one-page matrix that tried, or a couple pages actually, that tried to highlight for the different product categories or the different securitization approaches what was distributed and then what was left on Countrywide's balance sheet. And so those might be worth looking at, because I mean, that describes some of the key risks that Countrywide faced, and also the risk appetite discussions that took place at both the management level and at the board level.
When you say residual risk, is that like the Z tranche on a private label security? What residual risk was there?
When I think of a Z tranche, that's more of a residual interest rate risk.
Okay.
On a subprime securitization, you'd have an unrated piece that would have some interest rate risk, but it would also have credit risk on it as well.
And you guys are
because that would be, but that would be the first, that would be the first tranche to bear defaults in a subprime securitization. And just as another aside, I'm sorry, there were classes I did for the board where we went through the different securitization approaches, and I talked about the risks that Countrywide retained and the various approaches.
And just switching topics a bit, if I may, we've got a couple questions relating to the due diligence process, and in particular Clayton's Holdings. And we've learned from other sources that in 2003, 95% of Countrywide's due diligence the due diligence contracted to outside firms, Clayton Holdings had 95%. In 2004, it went down to 85%. In 2005, it went down to 75%. And in 2006, it dropped all the way to 2%. And so we're wondering if you can just talk to us about why the percentage fell so drastically in 2006?
Sure, a couple thoughts. This has been an area. So this is the underwriting due diligence is what this is talking about that's being done for the securitizations. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not going to have direct knowledge of this.
Who would be interacting with them directly?
I would. So the names I would direct you to. The first would be Josh Adler, A-D-L-E-R, and he's still at Bank of America. I would ask him, and he was on the secondary marketing side of Countrywide. And I'd also ask Michael Schlossman, and it's S-C-H-L, I think it's O-E-S-S-M-A-N, something like that. He was the manager for the broker-dealer on transaction management is what reported to him. So those are the two that I would ask, and they could most directly answer your question. Back in 02 or 03, Clayton had a huge market share across the market. So I'm just going to give you my general thoughts. They had a huge market share, and there weren't very many other firms in the business at that time. I think that changed through time. So that would have been partially what was responsible. I suspect there's probably more to it than that, which is why I'd recommend you guys talking to Josh and Michael.
Okay, thank you so much, Mr. McMurray, for spending this time with us. I understand that we have we're supposed to end relatively soon. Is that on your end?
Yeah. Well, if you have some more questions, we can try to fit them in because I want to be sure I've.
Right. So I do have some more questions, and I think that it might be the case, and I'm sorry to say this, it might be that we want another hour or two to follow up at some point in the future. But I'm going to try to get through as many as I can right now.
Okay.
Just wanted to go back and with some cleanup questions. In terms of reporting lines, who did you report to directly at Countrywide, starting as when you were the enterprise chief credit officer in 2003 and then sort of moving forward until you left the company?
Sure. So when I arrived at the company, I reported to Nick Kresnick, who was the chief investment officer for the company.
How do you spell his name?
K-R-S-N-I-C-H. So I reported to Nick when I first got there, and I continued to report to him. After he left, and I became the chief risk officer, he was also the chief risk officer in addition to the chief investment officer. After he left, I reported to Stan Kurland for a very short time, and then they moved Kevin Bartlett over to be chief investment officer for Countrywide Consolidated, and then I reported to him for the rest of the entire time I was there.
So when you first joined as chief credit officer, you reported to Nick Kresnick, who was the chief investment officer and the chief risk officer. He left, and then you reported to Stan Kurland?
Right, who was the president for a very short time.
Okay.
And then they filled the chief investment officer position with Kevin Bartlett, who had been a longtime employee of the firm. I mean, he had retired and then come back, and so then I reported to Kevin.
Okay. Who took over as chief risk officer after Kresnick left?
I did. They moved me to that position, but not exactly all the stuff that he had, but I took on some additional things after he left.
When did he leave?
He left, my recollection is 06.
And so when did you took on additional responsibilities, but you didn't officially become the chief risk officer until a later point? Or you officially became when he left?
Not right after he left, but a little while after he left, I did.
Okay. And then as you were chief risk officer, you reported to Stan Kurland and then to Kevin Bartlett.
Right, but only to Stan for a short time, and it was because they didn't have the chief investment officer position filled.
Right, so that was for a period of months?
Yeah, probably a period of months.
Like 6 months? Less than 6 months?
Less than 6 months.
Okay, okay. And then you reported to Kevin Bartlett's...
Until I left.
Until you left. Okay, great, thank you. And then in terms of... Did these people have... The person you directly reported to, any of these three people, did they report directly to the CEO?
No, they reported to the president.
Okay.
And I'm just going to editorialize here. I don't think it's a great practice. Ideally, the risk officer ought to report to the board or CEO, in my opinion.
Thank you for that.
That's just John's opinion. But
did you ever raise that while you were at Countrywide?
You know, I don't recall making a big deal out of that, and my opinion's become much more hardened on this point through time. After reflecting on what I observed at Countrywide, what I observed at WaMu, what I've observed here at the Federal Home Loan Bank in my chief risk officer role, my opinion on that has become much more entrenched.
Okay.
I didn't think it was as big of a deal at Countrywide as I do now.
So just to clarify what the reporting structure was, so the chief risk officer would report to the chief, the CIO, and then the CIO reported to the president, and then the president reported to the CEO?
You got it.
Thank you.
Did you ever have any interaction with the CEO?
Some.
How frequent?
Not frequently. He was out of town a lot, first of all, and then secondly, there were a number of layers between us. But I mean, there were times I interacted with him. I mean, as an example, a board member who I was close to recommended on two occasions that one memo was on subprime and one memo was on option arms that I ghostwrite for Angelo, who was the CEO. A memo described me summarizing the situation on the subprime market, and then a separate one on the option arms. So that would have been an example of where I interacted with Angelo.
Do you remember what the dates would have been for those memos, approximately?
I don't. I mean, I could probably look back and find them. I mean, they would have been 05, 06. The subprime, I think, was first, and the option arm was second. But late 05, early 06 is a rough time estimate.
Okay. In terms of staffing the risk department at Countrywide, how big was your staff? How many people did you have working for you?
When I arrived as the Enterprise Chief Credit Officer, I started with no staff, zero. I did complain about that because it's hard for me to get as much done just on my own. And so things were added. I was able to get things migrated over to me through time. And when I left, and this would have included a market risk area, an economic capital area, it was probably maybe 150, a couple hundred when I left. I mean, underwriting, as an example, never reported to me. That reported out to the production units. The collateral valuation, like, you know, the appraisers and land safe, that didn't report to me.
Okay. So I'm going to try to be very respectful, and I do have more questions, but I'll hold them for now, except to ask you sort of your high-level take, and this is something that we ask everyone, on what you think the principal sources of Countrywide's problems were that led it to face the situation it faced and ultimately be acquired by B of A.
So there's a risk matrix that I had put together for the board. We could try to track that down for you, too.
That would be great.
And so the way this matrix works is it has the Countrywide major risk exposure, so things like the bank loan portfolio, the rep and warrant risk, and so forth. Then I had risk drivers, so the major things that would drive the risks across those exposures, and then inside the cells would have been the bad things that could happen. And so what, in my opinion, what forced Countrywide into Bank of America's arms was the fact that it was so reliant on wholesale liquidity. Well, and there's an important piece that goes with this, but that's what that's the key thing that that pushed Countrywide into B of A's arms. And importantly, one aspect of that that we had talked about at Countrywide is even though Countrywide had a bank, much of their operations were outside of the bank. And so anything that was outside of the bank meant that they could not go to the Fed discount window. And that had been explained before as a risk. And then when the capital markets collapsed and the ability to do asset-backed commercial paper, to do loan securitizations evaporated overnight, there was no way for Countrywide to replace that liquidity, to replace that funding. They had backup lines, which were meant for just that, as a backup, not as a permanent source of financing. And in fact, one of the things that broke the camel's back for me is they not only hit those backup lines, but I had recommended that they back away from certain markets until the funding sources could be replaced, and they did not want to do so. They wanted to maintain their market position.
Could you be specific about who they is?
Dave.
The president.
Campbell. Yes, the president.
And what markets did you recommend backing away from?
So the commercial real estate market, the repo market, the correspondent, buying whole loan market. There's an email that I remember doing recommending that we back away from those markets while the funding was so uncertain.
And that email was before Countrywide topped the $11.5 billion.
It would have been about at the same time.
Okay.
It would have been around the same time. The loan attributes and the guidelines that we've talked a lot about, in my opinion, are very relevant to understanding this whole cycle. They're not terribly helpful in understanding what happened to Countrywide, because what hurt Countrywide was a more more mundane risk.
I mean, that's an interesting point, and I do think that I hope that we'll get the chance to speak to you again. And I think that certainly, at least speaking personally for me, one of the ways I look at it sort of in two ways: one is what happened to Countrywide, and two, what happened in the broader market that Countrywide was a part of and in a small or large way facilitated. So sort of those are the twin ways that we are looking at this. So, but I appreciate that.
I agree with you. I agree with you. By the way, and you know, back on that, my silly 3R guiding principle thing. You know, that whole feedback loop that you just described.
Right.
So a frustration to me was, and I talk inside the company with this, talk with the rating agencies about this, Fannie and Freddie. It's like, guys, what are we doing? So one person offers something, you know, so kind of in Countrywide would match it. And so what do you think that other lender would do once Countrywide matched that?
Cut price.
Yeah, they would widen further, and then Countrywide would have to match it again. And so this was going on throughout the industry. And I would encourage you at that April 2006 Fed conference to look at the write up on that. You know, these loan attributes that were out there, people were not. It was more of an affordability perspective. How do we get people into homes? And we had this whole competitive dynamic that you're talking about going on. And at some point, just like with any other cycle, it becomes unsustainable. And the other thing I would tie in, there's a feedback loop into house prices. So if guidelines widen, that lets new people into the market that can buy a house, that increases demand for houses. It lets people that are already in the market buy a more expensive house. That increases the demand for houses. That increases the house prices. The loans tend to perform better when house prices are increasing. so everything just amplifies on the way up. And the horrible thing about this is when all of it when it was going to unwind, it works in the opposite way too. So when people cut back guidelines, which is what happened when the market collapsed, less people can buy houses. People can buy only less expensive houses. House prices fall. That worsens the performance. People cut guidelines back now. And so that's the portion of the cycle that we've been in.
Right. Well, thank you.
And that cycle's occurred a bunch of times. And why people were not paying more attention to it this last time, I will never know. Because it was right there for everyone to see.
2007 and things like that based on the comments that Zillow made. And
You know, I'm looking at some comments that Zillow made through 2007, where, for example, in the first quarter investor call, he's saying that there's no question that many players entered the business over the last 5 years had, to some degree or another, irresponsible behavior and conducted themselves irresponsibly, and that impacted everybody. And he goes on and differentiates Countrywide from these other irresponsible players. And I was just wondering if you agree with that characterization, and if you think that Countrywide operated in a way that was more responsible than some of these other players that Mozilla is referring to, which include New Century and companies like that.
So I don't agree with him completely, but I do think there's important ways that Countrywide did operate more responsibly. So let me just spend a minute or two on that. So New Century, AmeriQuest, a lot of those others were not regulated. They had the state regulations that they had to follow, but they were not nearly as regulated as Countrywide was. And every day that I was at Countrywide, almost there was one or more Fed officials, you know, right there, which I think is a good thing, by the way. But as an example, if a borrower came to Countrywide, it was an explicit policy that if they came through the subprime channel, they had to be considered for a prime loan. And so there were a series of things like that that I think Countrywide was much more responsible. There were a lot of fair lending analyses that we did. You know, that was a topic that we talked a lot about. And so in many ways, I do think Countrywide was not only more responsible than those lenders that you just named, but they were also more responsible than even some of the other big-name banks that are still around and more careful based on my personal observation. Now where I would quibble, and I would quibble strongly with Angelo, is I did not agree with the matching strategy. I think for any very large institution, you can't just simply be a follower. And so that's where I would have disagreed with him.
Well, and it has the effect of importing into the company and to all of the good characteristics that you describe, a lot of the bad that was in the market.
Right. Well, the way I wrote it is just like seeding this part of the process over to the broader market. And they got debated, and even after Stan left, I can remember Dave Samble saying, you're bringing this up again, John. All right, let's debate it again. And it was with the senior, all of the senior folks in the company, and they said, we're still going to do the matching strategy. But again, it gets back to someone asked a question about risk appetite, and it is a risk appetite question. But I disagreed with the matching strategy. But to be fair to Angelo, there were a lot of things that Countrywide did that were more responsible.
That's very helpful. Thank you so much for your time, and we will certainly be in touch, and I appreciate you and Sean, I appreciate the offer to get us some of these documents, and certainly let us know if there are any issues we need to deal with, and let's just be in touch on those.
Okay.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. See you guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.